Our speaker this evening is a dear friend, so it gives me special pleasure to introduce her to you. Ann Milgram graduated summa cum laude from Rutgers College, received a master's degree in political theory from Cambridge University, and received her JD from NYU Law School. After clerking for Judge Ann Thompson on the Federal District Court of New Jersey, Ann joined the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, where she was a line prosecutor. She then moved to the U.S. Department of Justice, where she joined the criminal section of the department's Civil Rights Division. There she prosecuted police misconduct and hate crimes cases and became the lead federal prosecutor in the nation for human trafficking crimes. After a stint as counsel for New Jersey Senator, now Governor John Corzine, Ann joined the New Jersey Attorney General's office, where she served as the first assistant attorney general. Last year, she was unanimously confirmed as New Jersey's Attorney General, where she heads the 9,600-person Department of Law and Public Safety. At 36, Ann was the second youngest person to be confirmed in that office in its history. Ann embodies the best of public service. She has worked her entire career in the defense of the common good. Over the course of her career, Ann has prosecuted bad cops, crooked politicians, sex slavers, gang members, drug dealers, murderers, and mob bosses. And she has navigated with seeming ease the often macho environs of police departments, prosecutors' offices, courthouses, and state houses. She has done this with grace and style and without ever losing her footing or being overtaken by cynicism. Ann has the perfect blend of idealism and pragmatism. Her core commitments are shaped by the sometimes old-fashioned notion that the government can and must protect the weak. But this noble task requires work, work by highly competent, well-trained, and thoughtful lawyers, work that is not driven by ideology, but by a sense of possibility and promise. I met Ann many years ago when we were both young lawyers recently out of law school. We were both New Jersey natives clerking in the Third Circuit. In addition to being a whip-smart lawyer, Ann is a fabulous cook, a gracious host, a terrific storyteller, a patriotic New Jerseyan, and a good friend. Ann is what I want to be when I grow up. I'm honored and pleased to introduce her to you this evening.
Good evening, and thank you so much, Rich, for that wonderful introduction. It is a great pleasure to be here. When Rich and his wife, Risa, called to ask if I would come and speak at the public service conference this weekend, I agreed immediately, and I agreed because, first, of my dear friendship with them, but second, because I believe so deeply and so passionately about public service that it is a great honor to be able to come out and to talk to people, and particularly to law students, about why I think it's important and what I think it can mean for you personally in your law careers. I came from a family of public servants. My mother was a teacher and then became a professor. My grandmother was a teacher as well, my sister. And on the other side, police officers. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, and my uncle were all police officers. And my great-grandfather and grandfather were both chiefs of police of a very tiny little town called South Amboy, New Jersey. That's about 1 square mile, but also for many years had the dubious distinction of having the most bars per square miles in the United States of America. So I'm sure that they had quite a lot of work as police officers there. When I went to law school, unlike probably most of you who are sitting there today, I had really no idea what I would do. I thought I would do something in the public interest, as many I think people do when they go into law school. But to give you an idea, or what I usually say is evidence that I didn't know what I'd do when I grew up, is that I took criminal procedure pass-fail. And I said to every single one of my friends in that class with me, and there were 5 of us that took it, the professor had accidentally offered it pass-fail, and it was a 5-credit class. And I was arguing with all of them, you have to take it pass-fail. Who will ever practice criminal law? And, of course, I'm the only one of the 5 to go on to become a prosecutor. And I became a prosecutor after clerking for Judge Thompson, who is a district court judge and a true trailblazer in her own right, a phenomenal woman, who had been the Mercer County prosecutor in the state of New Jersey. She was the first female prosecutor in the state. She was the first African-American prosecutor in the state. And she said something to me when I was clerking that made me want to go and become a prosecutor and a trial lawyer. And she said that she couldn't believe every single day that she was a prosecutor. She couldn't believe that anyone paid her to do work that she loved that much. And I thought, well, I'm not stupid. And if I could love a job that much that I can't believe somebody pays me to do it, then that's the kind of work that I want. And I went on to the Manhattan DA's office, where I started with what I would describe as probably not the most serious crimes. Token sucking, for anyone who remembers the tokens in New York. It's now been outdated with Metro cards, but with tokens, when they were still used in New York, if you put a token in and it hadn't gone fully through the turnstile, then the token didn't drop. And so someone else, my preference was for the people who use the straws to get them out, but there were plenty of folks who put their mouths on the token receiver, and they would get the token out, and often they would sell them to other folks. Truthfully, my personal view as a misdemeanor assistant in the DA's office was that you should get to keep the token if you were willing to go through it. But I adore Mr. Morgenthau, and I never argued with him about prosecuting those cases. But I will tell you, I did refuse to do a search warrant on a token sucker. And this was a great experience in my first year, that police officers came in and said, we want you to do a search warrant on a guy who we think is a massive token sucker. And first of all, you're right to laugh. But second of all, what would you find? Just tokens. I mean, it's not evidence of anything other than someone who rides the New York City subway system. And I left there to go on to the United States Department of Justice and to take a job in what I consider to be one of the most fantastic units in the country of prosecution, the Civil Rights Criminal Section, where there are about 50 lawyers now. When I first got there, there were about 34, and we traveled every single week on a plane to some other place in the country. I worked on cases in Oklahoma, in New Hampshire, in Idaho, California, New Jersey, New York, and basically did some of the most interesting work. And I'll talk a little bit about it tomorrow at the panel, but particularly my trafficking work. I could never have done work where I could help so many people and do so much that I did was able to do at the Department of Justice. And the one story I'll tell you about the department is that of all the litigation I did, and I tried many of the first cases under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, and we did it in such a way as to develop the law in a way that we believed was necessary and important. But the most important thing that I did when I was there was to try a case called United States versus Coretto. It actually pled the second day of trial. It was eight defendants who had essentially victimized 50 Mexican women, some in the United States and some in Mexico. And they had taken the women and through torture and rapes and beatings and all sorts of absolutely horrific things, many of them very young girls, had forced them into prostitution, both in Mexico and in the United States. And I spent 2 weeks sitting across the table from these women and trying to convince them to trust me and to talk with me. And it was probably the hardest thing I ever did in my career. It took me over 2 weeks, actually, I think, to get all five of the women who were initially in Brooklyn to talk to me. And what I realized as time went on, I started asking them questions about their personal family situation, because they weren't willing to give me information about the defendants or what they'd been doing in New York. And I learned that they all had children. And then I learned as time went on that all their kids were being held by the defendants' family members in Mexico. And so obviously as a prosecutor, you can never make a commitment to anyone that you'll promise anything, right? Because you're a prosecutor and you have to take your witnesses and your evidence, and you simply can't make any deals. So I couldn't make any commitments to the victims in the case, but I did personally commit that I would do everything I could to get the kids out. And it took me about 2 years and a lot of hard work with the Mexican government. That's a whole separate story. A lot of running around and being told that there were no cars available to go out to this town in rural Mexico, and then seeing all the cars go by one after the next for weeks on end. But eventually, after 2 years, we were able to get four of the five children out. And that, to me, signifies the work of civil rights litigation. And it wasn't that the defendants went to jail for 50 years, which they did, and was very important to me. But what it was is basically being able to reunite families and make meaningful change in people's lives that you couldn't otherwise do but through this type of litigation. And I'll skip over a couple points in my career to get to the part that I think is most important for you guys. My current job is fantastic. Every single day something new and crazy happens. I feel luckier than I deserve to be. And I get to do things like anti-crime initiatives and childhood prevention programs. And I get to wake up in the morning and say, what do I think is a problem in the state and what can I do about it today? And that is probably the most gratifying work that anyone could ever have. But it's also been a very humbling and unique experience because, well, I am a little bit, in terms of other attorneys general, one of these things is not like the other. If you guys remember that Sesame Street song where there's all these kids playing basketball and then someone is playing baseball. I can tell a lot of people don't know that song, but if I started to sing it, you might, one of these things is not like the other. So my first day of work when I walked in as the first assistant, I ran into a very senior DEA agent, and I introduced myself as I always do. I put out my hand and said, hi, I'm Ann. We talked for a couple minutes, and then someone else who had been in the Attorney General's office for a long time said, Ann is actually the first assistant. And the guy who was a huge Irish DEA agent, literally was the size of my door, looked at me and said, well, I'll be. And the truth is, that's how I feel every day. Like, it's sort of surprising and amazing to be having this opportunity. But I didn't think about it being so different until I went to the National Association of Attorneys General Conference in Utah in December, when I was pulled aside, and as you can imagine, the demographics, most of the attorney generals are older white men. There are a few other women, and there's a little bit of diversity, but it's typically one of those rooms that you walk in and you feel like you've gone into an old family party. And I was pulled aside by five of the older gentlemen in the evening of the first night, and they told me that there had been an election, and keep in mind, they're almost all elected. There are 45 elected attorneys general. I'm one of about five who are appointed and Senate confirmed, but most are elected. So I was interested when they said that they had had an election, and it turned out that they voted me the most attractive attorney general. So I have that going for me. But the funny thing is, I'm also 25 years younger than just about all of them. So I did tell them that if I hadn't won, I would have been very upset. But it is an unusual experience. Every single day is different. The things that I wanted to tell all of you, and particularly the students, which I think are so important, is that I never had a plan when I went to law school. In fact, Rich talks about my cooking. I was an intern, apprentice at Le Cirque when I was in law school, trying to decide if I would go into pastry or lawyering. Many people actually think I made the wrong choice, which is a whole separate conversation, but I've actually loved my career in the law. But I never took other people's advice. And so I'll tell you up front, don't take my advice. Do what is in your heart. But everybody told me, don't clerk for a district court judge in New Jersey. But I was from New Jersey and I wanted to clerk there. People told me, don't go to the Manhattan DA's office, only go to a U.S. attorney's office. But I really wanted to try cases, and I knew that in the Manhattan DA's office they tried at least three or four times more cases than they did at the U.S. attorney's office. Folks told me not to go to DOJ because it was too specialized of an area, that it was so unique to be in civil rights criminal prosecutions that I could never get hired. People told me not to come back to the state of New Jersey. I had incredible job offers. When I left, when I was working for Senator Corzine on the Hill, I'd had offers to be, you know, chief counsels to the Senate Judiciary, to a number of Senate Judiciary members. I had offers to create whole new sections of lawyers at the Department of Justice. And each and every decision I made, I followed my heart. And I sort of figured out what I wanted to do and what was the right thing for me at the time. And up until becoming Attorney General, I had always said that I turned down many better jobs than I'd taken. And I turned them down because I wanted to follow my heart and do what I thought was right. So I think that it's so difficult when you're in law school because you do see that there's a path and you do see, you get a sense of sort of what the right things to do are. And to me, what I would say most important is that you have to make your own path and you really have to figure out what it is that you're going to be interested in doing. And trust me when I say, if you do what you like, you'll be good at it. I see folks all the time who are not doing work that they love. And the truth is, it's hard to basically bring that energy and enthusiasm and commitment to something if you're not crazy about it. I've also seen a lot of folks, and I went to law school with a lot of them, who wanted to do something down the road, who said, I want to be a federal prosecutor in 5 years. And to everyone who has those goals, I would say try to do it now. And try to start yourself on the path of things that you believe in and you want to do, because most of my friends who'd set those goals in the future never got there. And it's not to say that their choices aren't good choices, because they are, but I actually very much believe that we're lucky to have every single moment that we have, and that so much of life is taking advantage of those moments and figuring out what your path is and setting forward on it. The only other thing I would tell you is two other things. One is that UVA has an incredible tradition of service. When I was coming down here today, I thought about all my friends who've gone to UVA Law and what they're doing. And I will tell you, I've thought of four people in particular. One is counsel to Obama, to Barack Obama in the Senate. Another I just hired to be the statewide coordinator for prevention in the state of New Jersey. He's done work with children for years, having been at a law firm for a short period of time and then come to do public interest work. Another is at the EEOC in Washington, and another is a state senator in New Jersey. So of the four folks who I know who went to UVA Law, and I think I have one other friend who is also a prosecutor, of the folks that I know who went to UVA Law, they've all gone on to do amazing public interest things. And that is, I think, so wonderful and so important. And finally, I leave you with, I generally try to tell people the two things that I learned in law school at NYU, which is a fantastic law school. So if anyone sees formerly Dean Sexton, now President Sexton, please don't tell him that I said this. The two things I learned. Number one, Dean Sexton told me my first day of law school, always call people back. He said it to a whole class, auditorium filled with law students, and it stuck with me. And it is one of those things I can tell you that so few people do. I call everyone back the same day. And if I can't call somebody back, which occasionally happens in my current job, I'll have somebody else call. You will be amazed how much it means to people and how far it will get you in life if you just remember to have those small courtesies and to always be responsive. The second thing I learned, which has not been a problem in my public service career, is don't commingle funds. And you think I'm joking. Don't commingle funds. Right, so everyone in law school teaches you this, and you learn this again and again, at least at NYU. We learned it, I must have learned it 20 times when I was in law school. And I just remembered thinking, who does this? And then, of course, you graduate and become a real lawyer, and you read the law journals, and every single week, someone has commingled funds. Truthfully, you won't even understand it when you're in law school. It's one of those things that people tell you, and you think, what does that mean? When you go out to become a lawyer in the world, you will see people do it all the time. So those are the two messages that I learned at NYU, which I've taken with me and have served me well. It's a pleasure to be here tonight, and I wish you all well. Thank you so much.